The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So, the Reverend Jesse Jackson once said of Stax Records that Stax was not just a record company, it was a sound. It was a piece of culture. It was a moment of conscience and experience of mankind. At the right time, it meant a lot to us. And the us he's speaking of course, is the Black community. So it begs the question, how did a record label that was started by a white fiddle-playing bank teller and his older sister come to represent a high point of soul music and, for many as well, Black culture in the U.S.? And I want to be clear about what I won't be saying in this talk. I won't be arguing that every Stax song was a cry for civil rights. Sorry. Or Black pride, either conscious or unconscious, or that every Stax writer and musician saw themselves in their music as part of the movement for civil rights. Sorry, this is going crazy. But what I do want to argue is that often by chance, timing, and sometimes luck, there's a thread that runs through much of soul music in general, and in much of the history of Stax in particular, that represents what author Peter Guralnick calls the Southern Dream of Freedom. And broadly speaking, culture is, of course, to some extent, always a reflection of the world that produces it, whether or not those that are producing it means that to be the case. But in the case of music, you know, we often think about that political content in terms of lyric. You know, we know what it means when civil rights activists sing "We Shall Overcome" or "Keep Your Eyes on the Prize." We know what Sam Cooke was talking about when he said in 1963 a change is going to come, or in 1968 when James Brown said "Say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud." But what's less recognized, I think, is how, as left-wing music writer Rebbe Garofalo puts it, while there's a question that these lyrical changes are at times powerful, it is also important to note that changes in musical form, tone, instrumentation, production style, and personnel can be more telling. Mm-hmm. The Stax Recording Studio was started in 1957 in a town about 30 miles outside of Memphis by a guy named Jim Stewart, who's, as I said, a white bank teller who played country fiddle in a local music group called the Canyon Cowboys. He started the company, which was then called Satellite Records, basically because he wanted to make records of himself playing fiddle. He convinced his older sister Estelle, who had the one thing he didn't, which was a house that she could take a second mortgage out on, to take out $2,500 on her home in order to purchase what was, even at the time, really fairly primitive recording equipment. But Stewart's initial experience outside of Memphis taught him two valuable lessons: that you can't record next to a railroad track, and if you build it, they will come, but not if it's too far out in the country. So they decided to move the company into Memphis itself. And Memphis, you know, really would be the key to forming the Stax sound. And you think about the city, right? Memphis sits at a kind of crossroads, not just in terms of having ties between Black communities and musicians in the North and South, right? You think about the migration of Blacks north after the World War II, but musically as well, where there's an intersection of music styles. There was gospel music, right? This sort of full-throated church singing, the call and response patterns. And at the same time that the civil rights movement of the 1950s was growing, there were musicians like Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, and Little Richard who took gospel songs and reworked them for a secular audience, fusing really the sound of gospel, the keyboards, the soaring vocals, background choruses, and the call and response with R&B as well as country influences. And this was still at a time when radio was king, and everybody, including people like Carla and Rufus Thomas, Isaac Hayes, David Porter, and others who had become part of the Stax family, would listen to the Grand Ole Opry on the weekends and study the country music, you know, these tales of heartbreak and lost love. And thrown into that mix, of course, was also R&B. You know, think about Memphis being home to Sun Studios, which had introduced the world to Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, as well as the All Black Prisoners and Rufus Thomas. There was nothing intentional about Stax's eventual evolution to soul music. it was, you know, in many ways, it was actually a series of accidents that would shape the sound. For the first 2 years, the company didn't actually produce much of anything besides a couple of one-off fiddle records. But in 1959, Jim and Estelle, along with their then partner, Chips Moman, you know, decided, look, if we're going to be serious about making music, we have to move into Memphis. And again, nothing deliberate about the location that they chose. The deciding factor was money. They looked around for a studio, and the first place they saw was the old Capitol Movie Theater on 926 East Macklemore Avenue in a working class black neighborhood. The rent was $100 a month, so they took it. It was a happy accident. It turned out that the theater was within a short distance of several black high schools, including Booker T. Washington High School, where a young student and musical prodigy named Booker T. Jones went to school, along with a singer named David Porter. Booker T. and Porter both lived just a few blocks from the studio. Aretha Franklin's childhood home was nearby. There was also Hamilton High School, where aspiring musicians Isaac Hayes and Carla Thomas went to school. It was actually less than 2 miles away. So on the weekends, Estelle and Jim and whoever they could find ripped out the seats of the old theater. They didn't level the floor because basically they didn't have the money to do it. And this was another fortunate accident. The sloped floor of the theater, actually along with the primitive recording equipment, helped give the music they made a really distinctive, almost hollow sound that many Stax aficionados, not me, can identify within a few seconds of the beginning of a song. They can tell if it was recorded there or not. And in large part because of the primitive nature of their equipment, for years the recording sessions essentially were played live, right? Everybody playing their parts together or with just a sort of minimum of overdubbing, giving them a spontaneous and very immediate quality. Estelle also had the brilliant idea of turning the theater's concession stand into a record store to make extra money, which was another accidental stroke of genius, because if you want to know what kind of music is hot, well, what better way to find out than by having a record store? So local kids would come in for records, but they would stay for the chance to record. And Estelle Acton paid attention to what music was selling at the time, what records, what sound was hot. And when musicians like Booker T, you know, hanging out or on a break from a session were looking for inspiration, Estelle would say, you know, why don't you try something like this? So Booker T actually said, well, it's like having a music library next door. Local kids would come in for the records. Oh, sorry. Around the same time, they found out that there was already, unfortunately, another company named Satellite. You know, they were threatened with a lawsuit, so they decided to change the name to Stax, right? Stuart Axton Stax. I want to stress as well that it wasn't out of any sense of principle that Stax became multiracial, at least not initially. And you remember that Memphis at the time was strictly segregated, separate schools, separate ambulance companies for black and white. You know, the zoo was segregated, even the graveyards were segregated. But at Stax, there became very much an open door policy, in part out of economic necessity. You know, they wanted to record whatever would sell, and if there were young kids coming around who could play and who had bands, who cared what color they were? Estelle Axton would say, we never saw color, we saw talent. And Al Bell, who is black, who came to Stax in the mid-1960s as a promotions director and later would advance to become president of the company, he put it this way. He said, really, Dr. King was preaching what we were about inside of Stax. We didn't stop to think about it at the time, but that's what he was preaching, where you judge a person by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. But if the integration of Stax wasn't necessarily a conscious principle, it also wasn't something that you could take lightly in Memphis in the late 1950s and 60s. You know, trumpeter Wayne Jackson, who was one of the Memphis Horns, he explained that even just what it took to get a burger, he said, you know, it'd be me and Bowlegs Miller and Floyd Newman and Andrew Love in the car. I'd be the only white guy. We'd stop at this one Dairy Queen a lot, and it still had a colored window on the side and a white window in the front. My dilemma was always whether to go to the white window and get my friends mad or go to the colored window and upset all the rednecks. I'd just stay in the car and ask Andrew to bring me a cheeseburger. You know, obviously, you know, this is a guy who is anti-racist. He's playing with his friends, but at the same time, you know, it could be a scary place. As Jim Stewart would say of crossing the color barrier, you know, that's a real part of what Stax was about. We were sitting in the middle of a highly segregated city, a highly hypocritical city, and we were in another world when we walked into that studio. Now, coming from a white guy, this is, I think, maybe a little bit romantic, but Booker T, you know, and other black artists at Stax would agree, and Booker T would say that, you know, Stax actually was on the cusp of an upheaval that was coming in the world at large. Society was going to change, he said. You could feel it coming. Even my group, the Integrated Instrumental Group, it was a sign that things were about to change. So author Robert Gordon explains it this way. He says, soul music has many definitions, but I like to think of it as a bridge, the common ground discovered between black and white cultures expressed in music. These two musical fronts converged at Stax. The Marquees were an all-white band that included Estelle's son, Charles Packy Axton, on sax. These guys, all teenagers, were anxious to help Jim learn to operate a studio. They were also ready employees for Estelle's burgeoning satellite record shop. Aspiring musicians who came into the shop to buy the latest sounds quickly learned that the studio behind the curtain offered them a chance to make the latest sounds. And it was over the record counter that Marquees guitarist Steve Cropper and bass player Duck Dunn began talking with keyboardist Booker T. Jones and drummer Al Jackson, a dialogue that would soon lead to the formation of Booker T and the MGs, one of soul music's strongest, most successful bands. It was all these elements that combined to form what's since become called the Stax sound or the Memphis sound. I want to play a little bit of my favorite Booker T and the MGs song. This is called Time is Tight. It's actually a later song. It's from 1969, but I think it exemplifies their brilliance, and I'm guessing people have already heard Green Onions, which is, you know, their biggest hit that was made in 1962. This is about a minute and 30 seconds into the song. Stop it there. The song is really an epic in like 3 minutes and 15 seconds. It has like five separate sections to it. That super funky bass line from Duck Dunn, the fairly restrained drumming that actually ends up building towards the end of the song, the rhythm guitar from Steve Cropper, and then it's all tied together by Booker T's Hammond organ. Steve Cropper would explain about the sound the MGs achieved. He said it wasn't about the notes or the music of the music or the melody of the song, it was about the groove. Booker T and the MGs would actually become the house band for Stax, so in addition to various members also writing and producing. So when you hear Sam and Dave or Otis Redding or any number of other Stax songs, it's often these guys in the background giving the music that Stax character. This music was also strikingly different, it's worth pointing out, from the music being produced by the other major black record company in the U.S. at the time, Motown. I'm going to make it clear, there's nothing wrong with Motown. I love Motown. But when you compare the two, right, you can hear the difference, the polish of Motown, and the rawness and the spontaneity of Stax. So Motown was smooth, there was nothing left to chance. One author said the Motown sound was irresistible irresistibly danceable but not threatening to anyone in former content. And the reason for this is because Motown had the ambition of reaching a white audience, a white pop audience with a black sound, while Stax was mainly interested in reaching an R&B audience, not because they didn't want to reach a white audience, but because they knew they didn't have the ability to really do it, right? So over Motown, it's the sign said Hitsville, USA, versus over Stax, it said Soulsville, USA, right? Yeah. As Otis Redding, who really became the heart of the Stax in the mid-60s, would explain, Motown does a lot of overdubbing. At Stax, we cut together horns, rhythms, and vocals. Until last year, we didn't even have a four-track tape recorder. You can't overdub on a one-track machine. It should also be pointed out that where Stax musicians, writers, and producers like Steve Cropper, Booker T, Isaac Hayes, David Porter, were essentially given profit-sharing deals by Jim Stewart in the mid-1960s, right? The records would be produced by the Stax staff. At the same time, Berry Gordy, was not interested in profit-sharing. He was actually sending out private detectives to spy on musicians that he thought were trying to form a union. Now, in the early 60s, Stax actually cut a number of successful singles, not only from Booker T and the MGs, but from Carla Thomas and her dad Rufus, the Marquees, and I should mention as well that the Marquees, with its horn section, which would later evolve into the Memphis Horns of Wayne Jackson and Andrew Love, right? Wayne Jackson white, Andrew Love black, also would help give Stax its signature sound. The horns show up a lot on Stax releases. It was a very sort of fat sound. It was, often they would play in unison to give it more oomph. It was really when Otis Redding came to Stax in 1962 that the company took a big leap forward. Otis was from Macon, Georgia. He had worked as a well digger and a gas station attendant. He was a young singer, eager to make a name for himself. And on the trip up to Stax, he was actually working as a driver for his friend Johnny Jenkins, who had a session that day. But when they couldn't really get anything good from Jenkins, they decided, well, let's give Otis a shot on the mic. He ended up cutting a song that day called These Arms of Mine, which was released on Volt, which was a subsidiary label of Stax, eventually became a hit. And the next year he cut Pain in My Heart and basically started touring relentlessly and helping define the Stax sound. He would come into a recording session knowing exactly what a song should sound like. He'd have the horn parts. He didn't play the horn, but he'd have them fully formed in his head, and he would sort of sing it to the horn players. This is how I want you to do it. People talk about him in just glowing terms as a guy who, when Otis was in the room, you wanted to do your best for him. Wayne Jackson explained that the horns for Otis actually functioned as a second set of background singers. You don't have syllables, so you have to use dynamics tastefully, he said. Otis Redding's I've Been Loving You Too Long has great horn parts. You can almost hear the horns saying the words. They're also used like a rhythm instrument as that stop line, definite punctuation. I'm going to play a bit of this next song because I think it sort of typifies by the end of the song, the Stax sound. It builds into this incredible music moment with Otis going to this sort of full-throated manic state where he's almost incomprehensible. It's tense, it's raw, it's the style of singing that would become a hallmark for him. But I think there's a current of something a little bit more beneath the surface of this. Oh, wait. Sorry, I think I skipped. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to play this next song. This is about a minute and a half in.
It's not just sentimental, no, no, no. She had her grief and care, yeah, yeah, yeah. But the soft word they all spoke so gentle, yeah. It makes it easier, easier to bear, yeah. You won't be ready.
Okay, I'm gonna stop it. I know. I get this every year. It is tempting to just let the music play. That is like a hallmark of arrangement where for the first almost 50 seconds of the song, there's no drumming at all. And then it comes in with this sort of metronome beat, right? There's just a couple of piano notes, a couple of guitar chords, and then it just builds into this incredible intensity. Again, it's tense, it's raw, and that, you know, and that was really, you know, Otis's hallmark. And again, you can hear it on the next song that I'm going to play, but there, I think there's something, there's a current of something else between the surface of the next song that I want to talk about after I play just a little bit of it. Now, of course, everyone is also familiar with this.
What you want, baby, I got. What you need, if you know I got it. All I'm asking is for the respect of your family.
Okay, so. Now, Otis did his version in 1965, Aretha did hers in 67, and as soon as Otis heard it, he said, you know, I've lost my song, there it goes. And in one sense, both are very straightforward, right? They're pleas for harmony at home. Otis's version is this sort of desperate guy who's willing to give his woman anything she wants. He won't care if she does him wrong, as long as he gets respect when he comes home. And Aretha's version is a declaration, right, of a woman who knows that she has everything her man wants, and she demands his respect. Now, not only musically are they very different, although I have to admit that personally I kind of prefer Otis's, even though my heart is sort of a little more with Aretha's. But most music critics tend to focus on Aretha's version, right, as being the one with political content, the feminist song or proto-feminist song. And that's certainly true, right? People heard it then and today in that way. But I think there's an undercurrent of something else in Otis's version that often gets missed. Sure, on one level, it's a guy who's going out on the road, coming home and asking his girl to give him respect in the bedroom, you know, as well as elsewhere. But I think there's an element to which this song is also about what it means to be a black man out in the world and the world being against you and wanting home to be the one place where you have a refuge, right? So Otis's version of Respect was written by his friend Speedo Sims, his road manager. It was actually recorded as part of the album Otis Blue, which everyone should own. It's an amazing album. Actually, the vast majority of it was recorded in one 24-hour period where they recorded from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on a Friday. They broke so that all the session musicians could go play their regular gigs. And then at 2 a.m., they came back and recorded until 10 a.m. on Saturday. Now, also on Otis Blue, right, is Otis's version of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. Otis was a very big fan of Sam Cooke. He idolized him, even though their styles were very different. And I won't play Otis's version, but you know, you can imagine he Otisifies it, right? It's got the horns, it's rougher, it's more raw. He improvises on it. He also changes the refrain at the end from A Change Is Gonna Come to A Change Has Got to Come, repeating, you know, and I know that a change has got to come. There's a level of desperation to it. And I think it's not an accident that Otis's version of Respect and A Change Is Gonna Come are recorded in 1965. Or you think about what's going on in 1965. That's the year that activists marched in Alabama from Selma to Montgomery. The Voting Rights Act was passed. Rioting broke out in Watts. In fact, Booker T and the MGs and other sax artists were actually in LA. They had performed the night before in Watts as part of a Stax tour of the West Coast. And Booker T would talk later about how the black guys in the band actually got very protective of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn because they thought they might actually become targets of violence. 1965 is also the year that Stokely Carmichael coined the term black power. So I do think that there's a coded kind of undercurrent to Otis's version that doesn't often get acknowledged, but that especially for black audiences was there. Al Bell would say that segregated environment of Memphis, those times, the absence of equality, influenced how we wrote as writers, how we sang as singers, and how we danced. Now, this way that music has of working on multiple levels depending on what's happening in the world and who's listening to it, right? Think of the Motown song, Dancing in the Streets, right? Which had a very different meaning after King was assassinated and riots broke out. But, you know, it's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about music. And I think you can hear also this kind of coded message even better with the next artist that I'm going to talk about. So I just want to play a little bit of this. Oh, sorry. So that's Sam and Dave, who, along with Otis Redding, were sort of the crown jewels of Stax in the mid to late 60s. Double Dynamite, the Sultans of Sweat. There are a lot of very well-earned nicknames for Sam Moore and Dave Prater. They met actually working in the gospel music circuit. They sang together one night at a club, and supposedly, you know, Sam was singing, and he kind of went down and dropped the mic, and Dave caught it before it hit the floor and came up singing. You know, they patterned their singing style on gospel with this sort of back and forth call and response pattern. In 64, they actually signed with Atlantic Records, and Jerry Wexler, who's the head of Atlantic, would say, "Their live act was filled with animation, harmony, and seeming goodwill." I put Sam in the sweet tradition of Sam Cooke or Solomon Burke, while Dave had an ominous four tops Levi Stubbs sounding voice, the preacher promising hellfire. It turned out Atlantic wasn't suited to their style. They didn't know how to record them. So Wexler and Atlantic, which had an agreement to distribute Stax records, since Stax was still fairly small, took them to Stax. And Wexler would later do the same to Aretha Franklin, taking her in 1967 to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, to sort of find her signature sound. At Stax, Sam and Dave were able to find the right songs in the right atmosphere. And a lot of that has to do with Isaac Hayes and David Porter, who had begun a writing partnership. Both were local musicians. Porter actually sold insurance, but also bagged groceries at the supermarket across the street from the studio. Hayes had grown up in, just the worst kind of poverty. His mother died in a mental hospital when he was an infant. He was raised by his grandparents, who were sharecroppers, and when his grandfather died, his grandmother moved them into this city where they were just even more destitute. At one point, they had to burn the wood from their outhouse in order to stay warm during the winter, and Isaac would sometimes sleep in abandoned cars because he had nowhere else to go. Porter and Hayes actually had a rivalry in high school. They went to separate high schools, and both were very gifted musicians, though. So they would go to local talent contests, and it was, you know, always, you know, who's gonna win tonight, that kind of thing. And out of there, Porter was a singer and a writer. Hayes was a writer and arranger. He really doesn't get enough credit for this, and also a multi-instrumentalist. So he would actually, when Booker T went away to college to get a music degree, a lot of times Isaac Hayes would sit in for Booker. And out of their writing partnership from 65 to 69 comes most of the big Stax hits, including Hold On, I'm Coming and Soul Man. And the sound they helped create for Sam and Dave was really distinctive. David Porter would say, "I always kept Sam reaching. That was part of the magic. That was part of the creation of the emotion that you'd get out of Sam and Dave. I felt if the singer, if the singer was right above where they should be, then the anxiety and frustration of the soul would come, and the soul would come through." I always noticed with Motown records, the singers were so comfortable. I wanted us to have a little different edge. I didn't think you were really doing the record with any soul unless there was sweat. So Soul Man was actually one of the first songs by a black group to top the pop charts using the word soul. And you know, you think about the lyrics, they aren't just about romance, right? But they're about coming up out of poverty, coming to you on a dusty road. Got what I got the hard way, I'll make it better each and every day. Porter would say part of the concept that Isaac and I had worked off of was trying to be sure that the songs we created for Sam and Dave came out of a spiritual aura. Soul Man was a song that we were really trying at that particular time because of the times, because of the hatred and racial bigotry and this kind of thing that was around us. It was not in our studios, but it was in our environment. We were trying to come up with an idea that was motivational for a man, for an African-American man. We were coming out of our own experiences. Hayes would add that that was during the days of the civil rights struggles. We had a lot of riots. I remember in Detroit, I saw the news flash where they were burning the neighborhoods. When the buildings weren't burnt, people would write soul on the buildings. The big thing was Soul Brother. So I said, why not do something called Soul Man and kind of tell a story about one's struggles to rise above his present conditions? It's almost a tune where it's kind of like boasting, I'm a soul man. It's a pride thing. Soul Man came out of that whole black identification. We got funkier. Right? So it was becoming, soul was becoming synonymous with pride, with black pride and the idea that, you know, black is beautiful. And the mid-60s was really an amazing time for Stax. In 67, most of the Stax artists went to Europe on a Stax Volt review. The reception they got was amazing, and these sellout crowds, the Beatles sent their limo for them, and you know, like all they, when they all met Otis Redding, they bowed. Like they were meeting the king. You know, and that tour actually helped spawn the genre of Northern Soul that people might know about. After that tour, in June of 67, Otis with Booker T would actually play Monterey and Pop and just blew the hippies away. You know, they came on after Jefferson Airplane and just, you know, in their lime green suits.
Wow.
Yeah, but just as Stax was hitting new heights, a series of events would really shake them to their core. And the first and most devastating was the death of Otis Redding, along with 4 out of 6 members of the group The Bar Kays, in a plane crash on December 10th, 1967. It was, you know, a devastating loss, not only for Stax, but for soul music. And you think that Otis Redding was just 26 years old at the time, really just starting to hit his creative peak. You know, thousands of people turn out for his funeral. It's, you know, you read the reports of it, it's pretty stunning. But there was still actually another great composition to be released from Otis, and it was the song that's become since most associated with him.
In the morning sun, I'll be sitting the evening sun, watching the ships roll in. Then I'll watch them roll away. Yeah, yeah.
Now, despite Michael Bolton's attempt to ruin this song in the 80s, it stands as a masterpiece. And part of the punch of it is that it hints, right, it hints at a new musical direction for Otis that would never be realized. Yeah. He wrote the song while he was on a houseboat in Sausalito, and when he wrote it, he was very excited about it, but no one else around him was. He took it to his wife, his manager, and they were all like, I don't know, man, you know, it doesn't sound like a hit, but he insisted that this would be the biggest song he ever had, and his road manager, Speedo Sims, said, you know, he was changing with the times as what was happening. You can hear it, right, musically and lyrically. It's quiet. It's more introspective. This isn't a love song. This is, you know, someone grappling with internal demons, right? What is my place in the world that seems to be against me? These themes of alienation, loneliness, isolation, solitude, even down to the whistling at the end, which was not intentional. Originally, he had, you know, planned this sort of rap on the outside and forgot it, so he whistled. I think you can compare it to a couple of things. The first is Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, where, you know, which is about someone sort of moving through the world and being bombarded by these sort of external conflicts. But in Dock of the Bay, it's an internal conflict. And at the time he wrote it, he was actually obsessed with the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album, playing it over and over. And if you think about that album, the centerpiece to it is the final track, A Day in the Life, right, which is about John Lennon, you know, sort of seeing the news and wrestling with, you know, your own loneliness, your own alienation. And I think Otis was really grasping for a similar feel. But just 3 days after recording the song, he was dead. Steve Cropper went back into the studio, he cut the final mix, and he added the waves. The song was released in January of 68. It went to number one, but it was little consolation to Stax. Jim Stewart would say, I think the death of Otis took a lot of the heart out of Stax. And in the same week that Dock of the Bay was released, Atlantic Records was bought by Warner Brothers, and soon after it was announced that Jerry Wexler would be leaving. Mm-hmm. Without Wexler, Stax decided that was going to cut ties to Atlantic. You know, that they were growing, they wanted to see if they could kind of make it, even with Otis's death. But it came as a very rude awakening when they found out that the distribution deal they had signed with Atlantic several years prior actually gave ownership of pretty much the entire Stax catalog to Atlantic. So Atlantic had only ever invested $5,000 in Stax, but under the agreement, Atlantic owned every Stax master recording from 1960 to 1967, including all the posthumous Otis Redding material. So Stax sort of lost everything, basically. Mm-hmm. And to add insult to injury, Atlantic then claimed that no, they hadn't actually given Sam and Dave to Stax. They were merely on loan to Stax. So they also take Sam and Dave, even though Stax had been integral to their success. And actually, when Atlantic took them away from Stax, it basically killed their career. 1968 would bring another blow to Stax, and that was the assassination of Martin Luther King in Memphis on April 4th. Now, people know the Lorraine Motel in Memphis is the site of King's assassination, but the Lorraine also had deep ties to Stax. It was located just a few miles from the studio, which had no air conditioning. So during midday in the summer heat, the sessions at Stax would often break, and the staff would go over to the Lorraine, right, where you could be integrated at the Lorraine, you know, and hang out, cool off in the pool. It was also where artists recording at Stax would stay and sometimes write material. So Wilson Pickett's song In the Midnight Hour was written with Steve Cropper there. Eddie Floyd's song Knock on Wood was written with Steve Cropper actually in the honeymoon suite, which is like red velvet plush. You know, it was where they would go to be treated with respect and dignity. And on the day King was assassinated, actually, there was a session going on at Stax. They didn't find out until after the session was over. William Bell and some of the black musicians actually had to walk Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn out of their cars through a mob that had formed outside. Isaac Hayes and David Porter, you know, tried to go to the Lorraine. They couldn't get through because there were so many people in the streets. And Isaac Hayes would say that, you know, I went blank. I couldn't write for about a year. I was filled with so much bitterness and anguish till I couldn't deal with it. And, you know, the impact was immediate. It changed Stacks, but it also changed the world at large. So actually the day after the assassination, Duck Dunn went to, you know, not really thinking about it, he went to the studio to pick up his bass, and he said, "I got out and June, his wife, waited in the car while Isaac came over to talk to me. All of a sudden, these cop cars pull up, cops jump out and pull out their guns. They thought these black guys were doing something to hurt us because we were white, pulling them shotguns on Isaac. You want to see someone feel like an idiot? Well, it was our fault because we weren't supposed to be there. They had helicopters and shit flying around. This was an area that was off limits, but this was where we lived and worked. We were trying to act like everything was normal. And the next day, having to go down and face that shit, I mean, the cops jumped in because we were white. It makes you feel like shit." I will say, however, that I think it says something about how Stacks, I might need like 10 years. Okay. that it says something about how Stacks was seen, that in the heart of the black community in Memphis, in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, while other white-owned businesses were burned, Stacks and the record shop were left unharmed. But the racial tension in the neighborhood did ratchet up after that, to the point where some of the white musicians were getting, you know, robbed or shaken down on their way for money on their way into the studio. Booker T has gone so far to say that if King hadn't been assassinated, that Stacks would still exist today. I don't think that's necessarily true, but the point is that, you know, it becomes impossible to say that you don't see race when the most prominent civil rights activist in the country is basically killed on your doorstep. And what did happen with all of these major upheavals, you know, it changed the sort of atmosphere, the close-knit group that had brought together a lot of these artists. Yet even as this was happening, ironically, soul was going mainstream. So June of 1968, Time magazine, you know, ran a cover story on Aretha Franklin and said, "Has it got soul? Man, that's the question of the hour. If it has soul, then it's tough, beautiful, out of sight. It passes the test of with-it-ness. It has the authenticity of collard greens boiling on a stove, the sassy style of the boogaloo in a hip discotheque, the solidarity signified by Soul Brother scrawled on a ghetto stormfront." Okay, so it's so racist. Right. No, but you know you've broken through to white America and gone mainstream when Time magazine is talking about your with-it-ness, right? Stacks' answer to actually losing its entire catalog along with Otis and Sam and Day was an idea of Al Bell's called the Soul Explosion. And Bell is a really interesting figure. In 59, he had actually dropped out of college to become active in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He led workshops and participated in marches with King. But he left about a year later because of what he called philosophical differences. He said, "I left Dr. King and went back into the music business because I was not about passive resistance. I was about economic development, economic empowerment," right? And he really saw Stacks as an opportunity for that. So his soul explosion idea was that every Stacks artist immediately would record an album to rebuild the catalog. Was ambitious, but they basically did it. They released 27 albums at once in 1969. There was one that wasn't finished. One of the albums that was released that no one had expected to be a hit was an Isaac Hayes album called Hot Buttered Soul, which would eventually end up going triple platinum. Since so much other material was being released, Isaac Hayes was like, "Oh, you know, no pressure." So this album is crazy. Four tracks. Yeah. It has four tracks on it. The first is a 12-minute long cover of a Burt Bacharach song called Walk On By that he turns into this slow jam. It's really amazing. The last track is a 19-minute long cover of a Glen Campbell country song called By the Time I Get to Phoenix, in which Hayes does this, like, you know, 13-minute long rap at the beginning talking about who this character is. It's jazz oriented and has these really elaborate orchestral sessions that, you know, Stacks had never done before. You know, South Park obviously had a lot of fun with Isaac Hayes as Chef, right? And the idea of, like, you know, Chef is the ladies' man. But really, Hayes' album, Hot Buttered Soul, kind of pioneered this slow, character-driven sound that has almost on the album, it has almost kind of a psychedelic feel to it. It was very deliberately aimed at a black audience too. What it was, Isaac would say, was the real me. Okay, the real me had written those other songs with David Porter, but they were being written for other people. I took these songs apart, dissected them, and made them my personal tunes. I was targeting the black listening audience. Very few black people knew about by the time they get to Phoenix, yeah, no kidding. But I broke it down and rearranged it where they could understand it, where they could relate to it. It sounds radical because it had gone against everything that Stax had represented up to that point. In 1972, Hayes would go even further and have even bigger success with the next song I want to play. This is about 30 seconds into the song. Okay, I'm so sorry to shut it off. I know. In the year before Shaft had come out, Al Bell actually had wanted Stax to start going into the music or the movie business, and he met with Hayes along with the head of MGM and it's thought also Jesse Jackson to discuss making Isaac a star. And the whole score is really, actually really great for a first time. But the theme song is especially awesome, right? So these like 16th notes on the hi-hat cymbal and this wah-wah rhythm guitar. There are a number of criticisms you can make about blaxploitation movies, but you know, consider that the theme from Shaft actually is unapologetic song about a tough black man. It went on to be number one on both the R&B and pop charts, and won an Academy Award for Best Song, making Hayes the first African American to win an Oscar for Best Song. He performed at the Oscars in his, you know, cape and his chain vest. It's really awesome, and it was for him a step forward in both music evolution and political evolution. After he won his Oscar, he actually went to Chicago at the invitation of Jesse Jackson, spoke at Operation Push, and then went around to hospitals and jails, taking his Oscar with him so that, you know, people could touch it. And the idea was that it was his way of giving it back to the black community. Now, just to go back to the soul explosion period for a second, you know, even as there was this intense period of creativity with people like Hayes coming to the forefront, and Stax was actually rapidly expanding under the guidance of Al Bell, these changes also did bring about personal conflicts and some racial tensions to the front as well. It's around this time that Estelle Axton decides to leave, Booker T decides he doesn't like the direction of the company, Steve Cropper stays, but he basically gets taken out of his position as the head of A&R. Jim Stewart would say, everybody started withdrawing, pulling back from that openness and loose relationship that we felt we had had. While we were in the studio, I don't think that was ever affected, but once we were through, everybody went their separate ways. There wasn't that mixing and melting like we had before. You know, part of this is frankly, I think the outside world, you know, intruding, you know, not only King's death, but the more militant edge to the black power movement that was developing. But there's also the feeling among some black artists like Hayes that Stax really hadn't given them enough creative freedom and economic opportunity, right? So, you know, we're making all this money. Why shouldn't I get mine? Why shouldn't I be able to have a gold-plated Cadillac if I want? And, you know, I think you kind of have to respect that feeling, too. And for as much tension internally was coming to the surface at Stax, Al Bell in particular was attempting to take the company in a more external direction, a direction that was more explicitly tied to the black community in terms of actual outreach, right? Not just reaching people musically. Jesse Jackson, who was very much around Stax at the time, said, it was a very timely moment in the history of our politics. What was lagging behind was our business development. We could never produce our music. We could produce it, but we couldn't distribute it. We didn't own our own talent. You know, and they really felt that this was about black self-empowerment, black economic empowerment, and black people building an economic base. So within Stax itself in that period, there's, you know, again, there's a reflection of a certain current of Black nationalism and Black economic self-empowerment that had kind of gained traction at the time. You know, the downside was that it caused a rift between Porter and Hayes. They ended up never really riding together after that. But Al Bell, you know, really was sort of pushing the company to be more overtly political. You know, the company hadn't taken a stance on the Memphis sanitation strike in 68, but after King's death, Stax Facts, the company's in-house magazine, would, in addition to the sort of usual artist bios, print, you know, the SNCC Black Manifesto, which said all roads must lead to revolution. They ran pieces by Julian Bond and Coretta Scott King, features on abortion, sex education. The company also became, the company also became involved in donating money to charities like PUSH and the Angela Davis Defense Fund. They did sign the Staple Singers in 68, and really in 71, 72, 73, you know, it was the idea that the Staple Singers were going from being movement artists to bringing that movement and that message to the streets. I'm not going to really have time to go through the Staple Singers, but basically, you know, the writers at the time said, you know, when we saw Dr. King preach, Pop Staple said, if he can preach it, we can sing it, right? And that was sort of their idea. The last thing I'll talk about, since I'm super out of time, was Al Bell in 1972. You know, he not only set up a distribution deal with Columbia, so that basically by this point he had become the president of the company. Jim Stewart sort of remained president in name only. But in addition to cutting all these amazing Isaac Hayes and Staple Singer songs, 72 is notable because in that year, Stax signs a little-known comic named Richard Pryor, and his debut album would set huge sales records. In that year, Stax also carries out its most ambitious undertaking, which is a mega concert known as Watt Stax. And if people have never seen the DVD, the video, you should see it. It's awesome. It was a day-long concert in LA as a way of not just promoting Stax, but of giving back to the Black community. Ticket prices were kept at $1. On August 20th, 100,000 African Americans came out to the LA Coliseum. It was one-fifth of the Black population of LA, and it was the largest gathering of African Americans in the US to that point, with the exception of the 1963 March on Washington. The proceeds were donated to charities like Operation PUSH. It was an event not just of soul music, but soul solidarity, right? So Jesse Jackson gives an invocation, leads the crowd in the Black Power salute, as well as a recitation of I Am Somebody. Isaac Hayes comes out in his cape. Rufus Thomas is in his pink hot pants, you know. The film is really amazing, and what's amazing about it is it's not just a concert film. It's interspersed with these scenes of the Staple Singers and Hayes and other Stax artists are bits of Richard Pryor doing his material as a monologue for a single camera, because the director felt the movie needed a Greek chorus as a kind of conscience for the film, and I love that. There are also scenes of Black life in Watts, people in barbershops discussing racism and politics. It's really amazing film. And the contract for the film actually specified that in addition to the music, Stax and Stax alone would have the sole right to control the presentation of Black life, Black culture, Black language in the film. Al Bell said Watt Stax was designed to aid in perpetuating Black culture. It was also designed as a PR tool for Stax and its artists, and it was my investment in a training program for Stax Films to start prepping us for motion pictures. Unfortunately, the film actually never was released because it was deemed too controversial. But Bell said, you know, the concept was that Black music is a reflection of what goes on in the lives and the lifestyles of the people. We were trying to cause that to happen in the film so you could listen to the song and then see visually what was going on. Despite, just wrapping up, Despite its success after Watt Stax is really when Stax starts to go into decline financially. I can't go into the details, but basically CBS reneged on its deal. There were other allegations of financial impropriety. A loan officer who had been the Stax loan officer, lent them supposedly $18 million in fraudulent loans. Al Bell was actually indicted, though he was acquitted. There's a lot of high living too, right? You know, the fur coats and the gold-plated Cadillac. In 1975, Stax was unable to meet its payroll, and in December of 1976, the doors were closed by a bankruptcy court. To add insult to injury, the actual studio was demolished by the city of Memphis, though it's since been rebuilt to the same specifications. It was really a sad end to a studio which had for so long helped define what soul music and black music was in America. And it may seem trite to say it, but there's, you know, really no denying the legacy of Stax. And I'll just let the final word be from Public Enemy's Chuck D, as it always should be, who summed up the Stax legacy this way. He said, "The sound of Stax is almost like a good plate of food. It sticks to your ribs. It sticks to your soul. Soulsville, USA says it all." Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.